is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Chinedu Ofor, and here's what's coming up.
Their debt service repayments were mounting, and they were crowding out expenditures on health, education, and social protection.
That was Winnie Byanyima, Executive Director of UNAIDS, on how 64 countries, most in Africa, spend more money servicing external debts than on allocating more funds to healthcare systems. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok stressed in his address to the United Nations General Assembly on his country's commitment to peace and security in Africa and good relations with neighbors. However, he blamed Ethiopia for taking unilateral actions to fill and operate its Renaissance Dam that have a negative impact on Sudan. Ethiopia's Deputy Prime Minister Demeke Mekonnen responded, saying the need to use natural resources, quote, will not be stopped by a colonial legacy, unquote. Ahmed Fati, a global affairs analyst and a UN correspondent, discussed the contrasting positions of the two countries with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy.
If I'm going to compare both countries' addresses, statements during the general debate of the United Nations in the 76th session, I would say that both of them reflected common themes and disagreements. The common themes about the COVID-19 and the vaccination, the common theme about moving into the democratic transition in the Sudan, the common theme on the Ethiopian also about that Ethiopia over the past 3 years was able to conclude a first installment of the democratic transition. This agreement happened over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam known as GERD. The GERD remains an obstacle in the relationship between Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt, and it seems to be continuing. Prime Minister Hamdok stressed that the African Union mediation and sponsoring of the negotiation to reach a legally binding agreement is admired and respected. However, the stalemate is coming from the Ethiopian side. The negotiations to reach a mutually binding agreement among these three countries has been going on over rounds in the past 10 years, including rounds that took place in Washington, D.C. with the participation of the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury and the World Bank. Yet, at every junction, when there is a breakthrough and reaching towards the signature phase, the Ethiopians usually bail out. I don't see any indications that this strategy is changing. I see more that they are using the mediation by the African Union as an installment stage. The African Union did not set a time frame to reach this binding agreement. I don't see any more avenues or any points that was not covered. What's lacking is the political will and the desire to build on the spirit of cooperation.
Mr. Mekonnen said Ethiopia stands ready for diplomatic solutions to resolve the border dispute with Sudan. If that's so, how do you explain Ethiopia's reluctance to reach a legally binding agreement on the GERD as the United Nations Security Council recommended?
Deputy Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Ms. Mekonnen, when he mentioned that they are ready to negotiate on a bilateral level the border dispute, I think he was trying to throw in a kind of a form of distraction over the ongoing negotiations or the GERD dam. The Sudanese, of course, have interest into resolving the border dispute, but I'm not sure that if the maneuver will be accepted by the Sudanese, that border disputes in exchange of water, I'm not seeing a path for that.
On the Tigray conflict, Ethiopia's deputy prime minister repeatedly called the Tigray People's Liberation Front a criminal group. However, he said his government is open to peace initiatives while rejecting what he termed as punitive measures imposed on Ethiopia. What's your take on that?
Mr. Mekonnen, the Deputy Prime Minister of Ethiopia, described of the Tigray Liberation Front as a terrorist group. That's his narrative. Nevertheless, he also mentioned that raising the issues of humanitarian assistance is a pretext for foreign agenda, which this is something the whole world have seen, the atrocities conducted there. This punitive measures, and probably he's referring to the bill that President Biden have signed, putting a label on his country as a result of commercial news organizations that seeking profit. That was probably referring towards the investigative report was done by a CNN reporter in Tigray that showed mass killing, torture, and removal, displacing of people from their homes and mass graves. He is referring to it as an attempt to make commercial profits. I think Deputy Prime Minister McKinnon have missed a great deal of telling the world, in the light of the information that's been uncovered, the real situation and the real position. That was lacking very much from his statement.
That was Ahmed Fati, a global affairs analyst and a UN correspondent, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Sudan's transitional government reached an agreement yesterday with tribal protesters to end a blockade of exports of landlocked Sudan's crude oil that had threatened an oil field shutdown. No details were available on the deal with the Beja tribes in eastern Sudan. They are unhappy about a lack of political power and poor economic conditions in the region. A protest leader announced on September 20th that dozens of demonstrators objecting to parts of a peace deal with rebel groups had blocked the main container and oil exports terminals in Port Sudan. By Saturday, Sudan's oil minister, Gedeng Ali Obeid, warned of, quote, an extreme grief situation, unquote, with two pipelines blocked by the protesters. Delegates attending a virtual summit on improving health equity in Africa have called for greater accountability from governments and leaders in delivering on their commitments to improve the well-being and health of women, children, and adolescents. From Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Kayama reports.
You didn't know that I am the girl staying home from school because I don't have pads. My future, they took that. I am the girl walking to school with a stomach heavier than my book bag. This is my life. I am no different from the girl you heard about being sold off at 12 as a wife. I am not a charity case.
That's Kenyan poet Mumbi Macharia performing a poem titled Dear World Leaders during the opening of the online event. The meeting, held on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, specifically focused on sub-Saharan Africa. Natasha Kaoma is a youth advocate for women's health from Zambia.
In Zambia, we've been reminded of the power that young people have in democracy, in the just-ended election. And as young people in Zambia, we want to use this power for accountability and for speaking up and speaking out about sexual and reproductive health and the needs of young women. During the COVID pandemic, youth-friendly spaces have increased attendance by 25%.
She says Zambia's teenage pregnancy rate has remained high at around 28% over the last 10 to 15 years. The participants discussed the situation in many countries across sub-Saharan Africa, highlighting measures being taken to improve healthcare services through investments and better policies for improved access to quality services. Kwaku Adjeman Manu is Ghana's Minister of Health.
We tackled the pandemic to the extent that our normal service delivery, especially targeting women and children, weren't severely disrupted at all. We moved very quickly to try to provide PPEs across the country, and the commodities group, supported by our military, were actually moving things across the country to make sure that our health workers and all those who are attending facilities had these.
The Ghanaian minister says his West African nation of 30 million people is stepping up efforts to invest more in its healthcare system. Without a renewed effort, participants warned that decades of hard-won gains are at risk as the COVID-19 pandemic continues to disrupt and undermine vital health service provision. Helen Clark is board chair of PMNCH and former prime minister of New Zealand.
Over the decade, there's been a shift in what we've been talking about and with whom we're talking. And as we continue to advocate for universal health coverage, we must always be informed and guided by what women, children, and young people themselves say they need and want for their own lives, including the need for respect, dignity, quality care, and freedom from abuse.
But what needs to be done to empower vulnerable groups, especially women and girls, affected by humanitarian crises in fragile and conflict regions? Winnie Byanyima is the executive director of UNAIDS.
Without putting communities at the center of a response, prevention, testing, treatment, without putting rights of girls and women at the center, we will not solve this problem. We must learn from history and save lives. And I know many of you here are working hard to achieve that.
She regretted that 64 countries, most in Africa, spend more money servicing external debts instead of allocating more funds to the healthcare systems.
Ghana and Zambia paid four times more in external debt servicing than they invested in health systems before the pandemic. So even before the pandemic, many African countries, their debt service repayments were mounting and they were crowding out expenditures on health, education, and social protection. That is the situation Africa found itself in just before the crisis.
The summit also highlighted the use of digital technology for improving accountability and action to enhance women's, children's, and adolescents' health. Participants at the virtual summit, dubbed the Accountability Breakfast, included government officials, youth leaders, and representatives from non-governmental organizations, as well as grassroots campaign groups. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Theoness Bagosora, a former Rwandan army colonel regarded as the architect of the 1994 genocide, in which more than 800,000 ethnic Tutsis and Hutus who tried to protect them were killed, died in a hospital in Mali on Saturday. The 80-year-old Bagosora was serving a 35-year sentence after being found guilty of crimes against humanity by the then International Criminal Tribunal of Rwanda. Known as a hardliner within the party of President Juvenal Habyarimana, Bagosora was appointed cabinet director in the defense ministry in 1993 and took control of military and political affairs in the country. Bagosora was accused of taking over the affairs of state after Habyarimana was killed when his plane was shut down in 1994 and ordering the massacre of Tutsis. After the genocide, Bagosora fled into exile in Cameroon. He was arrested there in 1996 and flown to face trial in Tanzania in 1997. Bagosora was sentenced to life in prison in 2008, which was cut on appeal. Scientists say there is good news regarding the Irangongo volcano near Goma in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The volcano erupted in May, killing at least 32 people. The eruption wasn't as bad as the one in 2002, which was accompanied by an earthquake and sent lava into Goma. But thousands of people continue to suffer from the damage. Reporter Jaffa Al-Katanti tells my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson, a lake of lava is forming within the mountain, easing the risk of new lava flows into communities.
Last week, people of Goma saw a red color on the top of mountain, and no one knew about it. And in the end of the week, the Volcano Observatory of Goma sent a team at the mountain in Nyiragongo, and the team saw that the lake of lava has been active again in the volcano. So, according to OVG, it's a good news because since the eruption, the volcano was empty, and that was a danger for the city of Goma because no one knows were past the lava. Scientists say that the quantity of lava who left the volcano was not all the quantity of lava which has inside the lake of lava. But as the lake was empty, that was a danger for the city of Goma. Now, like the lava is in the mountain, it's a good news.
Now, tell us a little bit about the eruption earlier this year that caused so much devastation.
In Nyiragongo territory, some villages was touched and many houses. We are talking about more than 2,000 families lost their house.
Now, I understand that many of these people who lost their homes still have not been able to rebuild. Is help getting to these communities?
That's the problem they face now. Houses, schools, church were burned, but people were just placed in an area. There is no homes, there is no food. So we can say they are passing a very bad moment because they don't have any help from the government or from NGOs.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Khatanti in Goma. He spoke by phone with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson. Mali's transitional prime minister says elections that are aimed at returning civilian rule to Mali following two coups in 13 months will be delayed to ensure they won't be challenged. A meeting next month is aimed at creating a blueprint for the elections that have been planned for February. Interim Prime Minister Gokwel Maiga said on the sidelines of UN General Assembly meeting that a date could be postponed by, quote, 2 weeks, 2 months, a few months, unquote. The regional group ECOWAS has not yet responded. Last month, the bloc said it would impose sanctions, including asset freezes, on anyone holding up preparations for Mali's elections. In Zimbabwe, more farmers are receiving licenses for growing industrial hemp and medical cannabis. Andy Gondo speaks to chief executive of the Zimbabwe Industrial Hemp Trust. For over 7 years, her organization has lobbied governments to remove the legal and policy barriers to the farming of the two crops.
The Zimbabwe government has licensed 52 medicinal cannabis farmers and over 20 hemp growers to date. The government of Zimbabwe published regulations for growing and marketing hemp in September 2020. The permits authorize the holders to cultivate and process hemp for marketing purposes and to sell hemp products. They allow for growing, conducting research, breeding, and selling industrial hemp. Munyaradzi Mlambo of the Agricultural Marketing Authority of Zimbabwe says it plays a facilitatory role in the fledgling sector.
The authorities made it short and easy for farmers to acquire industrial hemp license. When a person has submitted all necessary documentation, it takes between 24 to 72 hours for a permit to be issued. But apart from that, the first hemp crop was planted last year and is at the late stages of harvesting. So the authorities also linking farmers wants to get into production with those who have acquired experience from this first batch so that there's an exchange of notes on best practices. We'll continue also to conscientize the farmers on the benefits, on the uses of industrial hemp and the lucrativeness of the industry.
According to verified market research, the global industrial hemp market was valued at about US$5.7 billion in 2020 and is projected to reach about $28 billion by 2028, growing at an annual rate of 25.17% from 2021 to 2028. Industrial hemp has more than 50,000 product applications according to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization. Its fibers have been used for years in creating rope and some textiles. But today, the demand for hemp is increasing due to its growing popularity among consumers as a health product. 31-year-old Zorodzai Maroveke is the chief executive of the Zimbabwe Industrial Hemp Trust. She attended the recently ended Zimbabwe International Trade Fair, which ran from the 21st to the 24th of September. She spoke about the organization's successful lobbying of the government over the past 7 years to get stakeholders the legal framework for growing industrial hemp and medical cannabis. She says a journey started with an idea she had while studying in China.
As you'd know, our regulatory framework was also very prohibited. You couldn't even talk about cannabis or do research. But then now with the lobby efforts where we've pushed for the past 7 years, we've achieved at least three pieces of legislation that have separated hemp from marijuana.
Which are namely?
Namely? Industrial hemp.
Being, I'm saying the name, the
legislation. The piece of legislation, there's SI 62 of 2018, mm-hmm. The production of cannabis for medicinal and scientific purposes only. And there's SI 208 under the criminal code, persons who may lawfully possess industrial hemp. And there's SI 218 under Ministry of Agriculture, the ARMA Act, which then legalizes the production.
Now that what she calls regulatory mountains have been removed, more work remains to be done. Kim Beethoft, a farmer involved in one of the hemp projects, concurs.
The industry needs an influx of capital, really. It cannot be self-financed, but that's the way it is at the moment. We need markets, we need off-takes. Once capital is made available into this industry, then it'll fly, without a doubt, because it is one of the most ideal countries to grow hemp.
Zorodzai Maroveke says that Zimbabwe is one of the latest countries in Africa to legalize cannabis and hemp cultivation, though she thinks that industrial hemp is a more sustainable bet. Observers and players such as Bateford and Maroweke say aside from markets and needed capital, the industry still faces challenges, stigmatization, and the need for an even greater public awareness of the benefits of growing hemp and medicinal cannabis. Reporting for VOA, this is Adegondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
Donkey owners in Kenya are demanding a permanent ban on the slaughter of the animals after a court lifted a temporary ban earlier this year. They said their donkeys have been stolen and killed to meet a demand for beauty products and so-called medicine in China. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
Kinampet Sampare is taking stock of his remaining herd of donkeys, making sure none have been taken. He says he did not worry about losing his animals a year ago during a government order that shut down donkey slaughterhouses. But since July, six of his donkeys have disappeared from his land. Sampare is convinced it's because the temporary ban on donkey slaughter was lifted in May, allowing the meat and hides to be sold again to Asian markets. He says when the donkey factory was closed, the theft had stopped. It had stopped because since then, no donkey was lost until recently when six of my donkeys were stolen and my neighbor's two donkeys. Tens of thousands donkey owners like Sampare are demanding a fresh and permanent ban on donkey slaughter in Kenya. In a petition, some 30,000 owners from 28 counties said their animals are vulnerable to theft from poachers. They say once stolen, the donkeys are being slaughtered for use in beauty products and so-called medicine sold in China. Animal rights groups are calling for a regional ban on donkey slaughter. Josiah Ojuang is the program manager of one of such groups, the Animal Welfare Africa Network.
We also had a chance as ANAO and as members of the Association of Donkey Welfare Organizations in Kenya this year to discuss with members of EALA, the East Africa Legislative Assembly, the need to have this removed not just from Kenyan laws, but all over East Africa. Because the moment you allow donkey slaughter in Tanzania and you stop it in Kenya, the donkeys will move across the border and come.
Kenyan authorities have appealed a court ruling in May that lifted the previous ban. That decision is due in October. In the meantime, the principal secretary at the State Department of Livestock, Harry Kimtai, told VOA that Kenya is not allowing the donkey slaughterhouses to operate without a valid purpose, such as disposing of donkeys that have naturally died.
Yes, it has been lifted by the court. But in terms of administrative, we feel that we cannot just go by what the court has said. We said we have no problem. We have not stopped them from slaughtering, but we are saying our inspectors will not inspect. And until you show us evidence that you are in the production systems of donkeys and therefore there is need for you to slaughter.
National figures show in 2019 there were an estimated of 1.7 million donkeys in Kenya. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I am Chinedu from Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat and dombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. and it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20.